Time to take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Thank you so much for listening in. Question about your pet's health? I hope you'll join us. The number 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
It's nice to be back. Hey, you know, anybody out there that's taking their dogs out on these beautiful days, make sure you're still using flea and tick control. Ticks are out in full force, and they love this weather. You know, this is perfect for them. So I think we sometimes think, it's not summer anymore. I can quit using it, but
keep using it.
I've been, I don't see flea cases very often here in Wisconsin, but I had three dogs infested with fleas last weekend. And that's kind of above average for my little practice. Yeah.
What about this dog appeasement pheromone? You've got some research on it being done in hospitals?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Dog appeasement pheromone, I bring this up once in a while on the show because it's a product that is similar to a product that they have for cats called Feel-Away. This one actually is called DAP. In the Feel-Away product for cats, it's the facial pheromone that makes cats feel good and relaxed and comfortable. This is actually a synthetic version of a nipple pheromone that mother dogs produce when they're nursing babies. And even in adult dogs, it has a natural calming effect. And it comes in a collar, a spray that you can spray, or a plug-in atomizer. And we'll recommend it for dogs with mild anxieties as part of our maybe treatment for separation anxiety and part of our treatment for storm phobias. But an interesting use is using it in the hospital. And, you know, I've always wondered if it makes any difference because when you hospitalize a pet, they're pretty stressed. They're away from mom and dad. They're usually having stuff done to them. And even though we practice good pain control, we still want them to be emotionally relaxed so that they'll heal better. They're going to be, you know, just more comfortable. And so they did a study where they used this pheromone and they sprayed kennels in dogs and cats that were being just in for spaying and neutering. Pretty simple standard surgery. And what they found is that these dogs, you know, were looking around faster, were much more relaxed and interacting with the people that were there versus hiding in the back of their kennel and being very stressed. And they measured a really interesting a hormone called prolactin, which is involved with milk release. And they find that dogs that are really stressed don't make as much of this. Dogs that are relaxed make normal amounts of it. And that dogs that were given this particular, exposed to this pheromone, had more prolactin. And so the theory is that if you have a dog undergoing a C-section, they're probably going to be much more relaxed, take on the mothering of their puppies, and produce better milk. So, and that's one of the big dilemmas that we always have when we're doing C-sections is how do we get a dog to be relaxed and be a good mother in those first few hours after having surgery done. So just something to think about. If your vet isn't using it in their practice, you may want to make a recommendation that they plug this in their recovery area and they may, you know, do a little bit better.
What about the Food and Drug Administration now? It has issued, I believe, a warning on buying pet drugs online.
Yeah, this is a big trend is, you know, and for humans and animals as well, is having online pharmacies. And it really is consumer beware. And so they've just, you know, published a little document that is just gives some guidelines as to what people should be looking for. And probably one of the most important things that you can look for is on the website. And I went through and checked kind of all the ones that I recommend. And I don't really want to name names, but you can, you know, if you just Google pet meds, you'll get the top like six or so in the country. But you want to look for a little logo that says VET, vet, VIPPS. And it's an accreditation service that they can voluntarily go through that says that, you know, they have a pharmacist on staff and that they're following all the guidelines for dispensing medication. You should always be working with your veterinarian. There are some websites that are available. They're primarily overseas websites that will dispense drugs without a prescription. You don't know if you're getting the actual drug. You may not be getting the right dose. And there are many drugs that people buy, like non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, that require a lot of veterinary monitoring before, during, and so on while they're on this medication. So just beware. Look for that little symbol and work with your veterinarian. And, you know, your dog will be safe.
All right. Well, we had Dan in Duluth has a question for you. Dan, hello. Oops, just a second here. Dan, there you go.
Hello?
Yes,
hello.
Go ahead.
What do you know about the Iams? Seems to be a shortage in all the bigger stores for their dog food.
Huh. I wasn't aware that there was a shortage of the Iams products. I know that there have been a number of pet food recalls, and Iams was one of the companies that recently had were able to culture salmonella in some of their food. Anytime you're making food that involves meat or, you know, meat from animals, you're going to find that salmonella can possibly be there. There were no reports of any ill pets. This was a voluntary recall, and that affected primarily their therapeutic line of diets. But I'm not aware of them, you know, and it may just be, you know, for the over-the-counter products, something with packaging, shipping. I don't know. I've not heard that that's an issue. But there is another pet food that got recalled recently. And it's one that many people have been switching to because they want to go to a high-end, like no-grain, all-meat diet. And it's the one called Blue Buffalo. And when multiple cases, and I can't remember, it was 30-some-odd cases across the country. They had too much vitamin D in the food, and it caused the animal to become hypercalcemic, have too high calcium levels, and made them very ill, can result in kidney issues and death if it's not treated. And so far, all of the pets that were symptomatic survived, and they didn't have any trouble. But it just goes to show you that even the foods that you think are absolutely, you know, perfect, that, oh, there's no grain, so don't have to worry about melamine. There's always going to be something. So when you're feeding pets, make sure that you, you know, keep on the ball when it comes to recall issues.
Thanks, Dan, for calling. Christy in Duluth, we turn to you now. Hi, Christy.
Hi there. My question is about making your own food at home. We don't like to buy store food for our dogs, and so we're just wondering some of the do's and don'ts. There's lots of information online, but I would like to hear it from you.
Well, I will give you, kind of in a nutshell, my basic thing when you're assessing a recipe, that you want to make sure that at least all the five food groups appear in the recipe. And by that, I mean there needs to be a source of carbohydrate or fiber, and that's usually in the form of a cooked cereal, so that should be in there. I do not like to see owners feed raw diets because I just mentioned the salmonella problem. E. coli can be a big issue. And unless you're extremely careful with your utensils and handling this, it's just unsafe around children. In fact, if you are using raw protein sources, there are many dog therapy groups now that are banning dogs from eating raw diet, that are eating raw diets, from participating in pet therapy. So just, you know, be aware that it's becoming a big issue. So carbohydrate, a protein source, animal origin, and it should be cooked, a fat source of some kind. And then we also should have minerals, in particular calcium. And this is where I find that many owners fall down on the recipe. They are cooking meat and vegetables and put grains in and so on, but they forget that all important vitamin, mineral, and source, and then, you know, obviously the vitamin mineral stuff that I just mentioned too. You want to find a recipe that is, especially for dogs, it should be about 3 parts carbohydrate to 1 part protein. That seems to be a really good level. And what I'll find is many home cooked diets, they throw in too much protein and it's unnecessary. So 3 to 1. And then good quality sources of protein, preferably animal sources of protein over vegetable, so skeletal muscle and so on. And, you know, kind of trade it off, different types of protein, because they can have different amino acid profiles. So don't stick with chicken the whole dog's life. You know, trade it off a little bit and make sure that you are giving a little bit of variety that way. And that, you know, if you, again, are, you know, following a good recipe and providing the right source of supplements at the right level, you should be fine. But just no recipe shifts.
All right. There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it, Christy. Randy and DePere, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Randy.
Hi, Sandy, Larry. I have a one-year-old Burmese cat, and I guess it developed a little bit of gingivitis. So the vet yesterday prescribed him some clindamycin hydrochloride drops, 2 milliliters by mouth once daily until gone, and it's a 20-milliliter bottle. We gave it to him yesterday, and today he looks like he's going to vomit. Is this the right kind of drug for this?
Well, clindamycin is an excellent antibiotic for oral bacteria. I would probably, in a one-year-old cat, not be looking at treating gingivitis with an antibiotic. And like any antibiotic, some humans and pets and so on just don't tolerate them. So I would make sure that you talk to your veterinarian and say, you know, I think this drug is making my cat nauseated. But some of the more common causes of gingivitis in a young cat would be things like, you know, making sure that their immune status is normal. I assume that, you know, you've hopefully had your cat tested for feline leukemia and FIV, feline immunodeficiency virus, to make sure that they're not immunocompromised. I'd be making sure that you're using a toothbrush and perhaps a medicated toothpaste that has chlorhexidine in it if your cat tolerates that. Perhaps using a dental diet that is a bigger chunks of food that the cat has to chew, and that helps kind of squeegee the, you know, plaque and things off the teeth. If the standard care that way isn't doing the job, then we start looking into some of the more weird and wonderful things that can cause a pretty severe gingivitis in cats. And there is a condition that we see called LPGS, lymphocytic plasmacytic gingivitis stomatitis. And that's a biopsy diagnosis. And in those cats, it's because they have an immune response to the plaque buildup on their teeth that is way beyond what a normal animal would have. I just had a cat in the other day that by the time it was 2 ended up having to have full mouth extractions just to be able to keep everything out of its mouth, and now it's a happy cat. But it had such a severe inflammatory change in its mouth. So, I'd probably nix the antibiotics, but again, talk to your veterinarian. They may have seen something in there that I'm not seeing, and obviously because I don't have your cat in front of me, but I'd approach it probably from more just the standard oral hygiene protocol.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Paul in Sun Prairie, on to you now. Hi, Paul.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have an American Eskimo that every year, every spring, at least 4 times, I have given him his spring buzz. And his back hair is always slow to grow back, but it always makes it by snowfall. This year, not so much.
Okay.
I have a bald dog.
Oh, and how old is your dog?
He's eight.
Okay. Is he overweight?
Slightly.
Okay.
He lives good.
Okay.
As far as the food goes, he doesn't get much exercise because of various situations.
Okay. But. Well, a couple things that I would look into when you clip a dog down and you just don't get the normal hair growth coming back. I worry about endocrine problems or hormonal problems. Probably number one I would think about would be hypothyroidism, a low active thyroid gland. That the thyroid's really important in maintaining the coat and coat density. And when we see, especially on like truncal obesity, meaning that there's hair on his head, on his neck, and on his legs, but kind of the rest of the body is just kind of sparse hair coat. That's real classic for that. And it's a simple diagnosis, just having a blood sample drawn. So that would be one of the first things I would recommend, is getting him looked at for that. There are some other endocrine problems as well that can cause thinning of the hair coat. There's a condition called Cushing's disease, which is overactive adrenal glands. So, you know, looking into that may be, you know, kind of secondary down the road. But get them checked for a thyroid condition first. It's easy to treat.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Sandy in Dubuque, Iowa, we turn to you. Hi, Sandy.
Oh, good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Sure. I have a miniature schnauzer. He's a senior citizen. And he has all these fatty tumors on his chest.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are hard fat. Some of them are the lipid types of tumors. Is there any treatment for that? Because I know it's now impinging on his breathing.
Oh, my goodness. Well, when we have lipomas are a very common tumor in dogs. They usually occur under the skin. Like you said, they can feel different depending on where they're located. Sometimes they'll be under a muscle belly. Sometimes they'll be just under the skin and you can feel them a little bit easier and they're a little softer and squishier. But these are, when you surgically remove them, just a ball of fat. It's their benign fatty growths. And almost every dog, as they get older, will get at least one. Some dogs are just very prone to getting these. I always remember, and unfortunately this dog just passed away, but there was one of my favorite patients. His name was Peter. He was a Doberman that was head-to-toe lipomas, and Dobermans always sit so, you know, proud and elegant, He had two big lipomas on the front of his chest, and we always joked that when he was sitting there and looking at us, it looked like he had better cleavage than most of the women in the clinic. So, you know, we don't usually worry about them. They're more cosmetic than anything. When we do get concerned is when they start making it difficult for the dog to walk because they're in the armpit. I had a dog in the other day that was a service dog that had to wear a harness, and they had a lipoma right under the harness. That one we removed. We had another dog in recently that had a fairly large, firm one on his sternum. So every time he would lay down, it would be like us taping a tennis ball to our chest and then trying to sleep on our stomachs. You know, it would be really uncomfortable. So there are times that we do remove them. And if your dog has enough of them that, and I'd be really concerned if it's, you know, usually they're so external, they're not going to impinge on breathing unless they're up in the neck area. But be looking at other reasons why your dog may have trouble breathing. Is it just overweight, or does it have heart disease or lung disease? So, yeah.
Well, he has chronic pancreatitis, and so his, and that's very well managed with the powder, And I weigh all of his food, so he stays 16 pounds all the time.
Okay.
So it's not like that. But is this common in miniature schnauzers?
It's just common in dogs in general, you know, and in people too. You know, I've had owners say, "Hey, I've got one of those," and they, you know, it's kind of grosses me out. That's why I'm a veterinarian and not a physician, you know. And they start rolling up their sleeves and showing me their lumps and bumps. I draw the line. So, yeah.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Sandy. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest as we talk your pet's health. Sandy, we had an email from Brad wondering, here's his question, is beet pulp one of the worst additives to dog food, resulting in many maladies with common allergic reactions?
No. I'm going to say no right off. Okay, the most common thing that dogs have allergic reactions to is usually the protein source, if you're going to have a dog with food allergies. And food allergies are actually not that common. Environmental allergies are going to be much more common, pollens, molds, and so on, than the protein in the diet. Beet pulp is a really good source of fiber. It is quite high in a chemical called, let me see if I can get this right, fructose oligosaccharide, FOS. And what that is a prebiotic. It is something that feeds the healthy bacteria in the gut to help maintain the normal flora in the intestinal tract and a healthier intestine. So it's included in many pet foods. It's not just there as filler. There is actually a purpose for it. And so, no, if you're finding a food with beet pulp in it, doesn't mean it's a bad food at all.
And someone wondered if you could name again the dog calming agent that you mentioned earlier.
It's called DAP, Dog Appeasement Pheromone. And they sell it at pet stores, and your vet clinic should have it. I have a lot of clients that just their dog walks around with this little collar on, and they just, you know, live with it, kind of always walking around in a DAP haze. And, and they swear that when the collar wears out, they start noticing a difference in their dog's behavior.
Carl in Fenimore, we turn to you next. Hi, Carl.
Hi, Sandy. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good. I just got a Siberian Husky from the Humane Society, and he's 6 months old, and he's about 18 inches high and 2 foot long from shoulder to tail. I was just wondering if you know or how familiar you are with how big this breed will get. I've seen some bigger, larger dogs. And I wonder if I have a large dog or...
Yeah. The fact that he's 6 months old, he's probably reached, at this point, 75% of his body weight and his growth. Pardon me?
Ooh. Outstanding. Okay.
Yeah. He's probably about 75% of his body growth. So, but even in the Siberian Husky line, there's the little miniatures called the Klikai that they've selected for and have now got a whole line of miniature Huskies. And we'll see them up to 100 pounds of body weight. And I get them confused with Malamutes sometimes because they are so big. So there is a lot of genetic variation. And unfortunately, what you really need to do is look at who was mom and dad. And when it comes from a shelter like this, you may not be able to have a good idea of how he's going to grow. But I usually tell people once they get to be, you know, 4 months of age, if you take their weight and double it at that point, that's probably what they're going to be as an adult. The fact that he's 6 months, he's probably well on his way to being his adult weight.
Okay, great.
All right.
And I have two more questions real quick. With the dog's eyes, one's brown, one's gray.
Mm-hmm.
Is that common with the breed? And then a follow-up question, kind of not related. When a dog gets rabies, how fast does that onset? And I can take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay. Well, heterochromia iridis is the medical term. Ophthalmologists like to come up with these really tough names, okay? Don't ask me to spell it. That just means two different colored eyes. I have a sister that has this, except she has one eye that's half gray, half brown, and the other eye's brown. So it even happens in humans. And it's just really common in the Husky breed to have those two colored eyes. And it doesn't mean that there's any health risk at all to the dog. When it comes to rabies, unfortunately, you're off the air. I don't know if you meant if it got exposed to a wild animal that may have bitten the dog. How long does it take for them to become showing signs of rabies? If that's the case, I mean, that's why we have a dog or a cat that has been exposed to a wild animal. We have a 6-month quarantine on those dogs and cats because it can be extremely variable for, you know, up to 6 months before they start showing clinical signs of rabies. But if you're talking about the vaccine, usually within a couple of weeks, you're going to see a good spike in their antibody level. So when I have patients that we need to be checking before going over to Europe or whatever, we'll vaccinate and then a month later check our blood levels to prove to the European animal import people that they are indeed, you know, vaccinated and have a good rabies titer. So 2 to 4 weeks after being vaccinated.
All right. Susan in Bristol, we're on to you now. Hi, Susan.
Hello. Hello. How are you today?
Great. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I have a dog. His name is Duke. He's 3 years old and he's half black lab and half bloodhound. And he has not been neutered yet, and I'm really teetering on the fence about this because I live on several acres, and I live by myself, and I'm a small person, and I have him for not just companionship but for protection as well, and he has proven his ability to scare someone away if I want them to go away.
Yeah.
I'm worried that neutering him may take a little bit of that testosterone edge off him. He's not he doesn't sniff people. He doesn't go running after other dogs or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
He's not showing any problematic behavior with the testosterone. He doesn't
jump. Good. Well, I can tell you what we know about neutering is it's probably not going to have any effect on his hunting ability, his protection ability. In fact, all of the police dogs that are used in the force that are males are neutered, and yet they can still be good at apprehension, scent work. You know, if they're trained appropriately, they're going to continue to do that. It's not based on testosterone. It's training. So, but the things that we know neutering does have some effect on from the health standpoint, testicular cancer, obviously. Testicles are gone. You're not going to have that. Prostate disease is, probably the big thing that we will see a difference in. Not prostatic cancer, but what's called benign prostatic hyperplasia, where the prostate gets big and the dog has difficulty defecating, more prone to infections and so on. And then there's other conditions like perianal tumors that are very testosterone related as well. From the behavior standpoint, we're going to see a male dog that is less likely to fight with other boy dogs, less likely to wander and go looking for love, maybe a little less with
coyotes. I was worried about maybe him wanting to try to mate with coyotes.
Yeah, well,
that was my worry.
Yeah. Yeah, well, if you're letting him run free, that's always a possibility that he's going to be, you know, looking for love in all the wrong places. So I think if you want a good protection dog that wants is going to be a good household buddy for you and stay healthier longer, get him neutered.
There you go.
you.
You're welcome.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And we turn to Lucille in Green Bay. Hi, Lucille.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I have what is called a Manchester Doberman. It's the middle breed. And she's really overweight, and she's got a lot of bumps all over her body, which the vet says are fatty tissue cysts.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't do, she says not to do nothing about them, and we can drain them, but they're going to come back.
Yeah.
But I have been trying to all kinds of different diets, and she just will not lose weight.
Well, you know, whenever we have a weight loss dilemma, the person that called earlier that has the American Eskimo that was not growing hair back, we want to rule out, is there a medical reason for it? And so going in for a complete physical, some blood work, making sure that the dog doesn't have something wrong like being hypothyroid
We did all that.
Good. So then the next step is actually figuring out how many calories a day your dog needs to eat and coming up with a feeding regimen that will only allow your dog to get the number of calories that they need to be able to support their normal weight. And so it's not just feeding a particular food. It's the amount of food you're feeding. And
I give her a cup.
Yeah,
a cup of food a day.
A cup for some dogs. And I can tell you, I went to a friend's house not too long ago, and they have a dog, a lab named Lily, that was very overweight. And when I said, well, how much do you feed the dog? They said, just 2 cups a day. And I asked to see the cup, and it was a 4.5-cup stadium cup.
Mine is a cup.
Okay, good. So make sure you're using the right measurement.
Yeah.
I don't know how many calories are in the food that you're feeding, and this is the tough part.
I have tried just about every kind of dog food out there.
Has your veterinarian actually figured out your dog's caloric needs for you? Because that is what needs to be done, is they need to come up with a number for you and find out if you're overfeeding. And things to be remembering, too, is that there's a lot of other things that we give our dogs that are pretty high in calories, like rawhide, dog treats.
She won't eat that.
She won't eat rawhide.
We give her these little cookie type things.
And even
little,
those.
But they're little. They're only about an inch long.
Those still have to be counted as part of her calories. And so going in and saying, this is what I'm feeding my dog. Here are the treats I'm using. And these are all things that a veterinarian can look up and say, okay, you can feed this amount of food, this many treats, and that's it. And the other half of weight loss is exercise. Just reducing the food intake is going to be great, but like with us, we have to get out there and start burning those calories. One of the things that's just recently been out on the market is, and it's to help people like yourself that may have, you know, trouble with understanding like how many calories my dog needs to get, is Hill's Prescription Diet has come out with a weight reduction program. And it's basically, I don't mean to be naming a company, but like Jenny Craig for pets. It's pre-measured bags of food and biscuits. And so your veterinarian figures out how many of these little packages your dog gets to eat a day and how many treats. So you still get the treats, but it's in very like pre-measured amounts. So it takes the guess out of, you're not using a heaping cup. It's exact. You know exactly what your dog's getting. My beef with this is that, you know, the average person's able to count 2 dog biscuits and can use a measuring cup and so on. But, you know, you never know. It may make life a little bit easier for everybody. So good
luck.
There you
go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Yeah, maybe it's 3/4 of a cup.
Yeah, it may be. And that may be all it is, you know. And it's, you know, you do that day after day and the dog's spending his life sitting on the couch, you know.
Yeah.
But get out, lots of walks. And I love the little saying that, you know, an overweight dog usually comes in with an overweight owner. You know, if you've got, you rarely see a fit owner with an overweight dog because they're doing things with the dog, too. So, you know, it benefits everybody. Everybody gets out and exercises.
Heidi in Denver, Colorado, listening online. Hi, Heidi.
Hello from Colorado.
Thanks for calling.
I just want to let everyone know that I am still a WPR member, even though I moved to Colorado 2 years ago.
Oh, so good. Yeah.
So my question is, I have a 3-year-old Boston Terrier. I adopted her about 7 months ago. And throughout the whole entire time I've had her, she has had a swallowing problem. What I mean is that sometimes in the middle of the night, she'll wake up and kind of move around, and you can hear her swallowing.
Mm-hmm.
She often does it during the day as well. Seems to be a little bit more prevalent maybe when her mouth is dry or when she's been lying down.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me just briefly tell you that we've told this to several different vets, and the main possible diagnosis would be acid reflux or just a behavioral thing. She is quite a skittish little dog, and so it could just be related to her anxiety.
Yeah.
We have ruled out that she does not have mega esophagus, which I won't explain now, but they've done a barium x-ray for other reasons. We have tried a couple of different acid reducers.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't really have any effect, and she is now on an SSRI antidepressant, which should be alleviating some of her anxiety, and yet the swallowing still continues. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that, if there might be something unusual we want to look at. She's had several thorough exams in the 7 months we've had her, so we're not sure where to go from here.
Yeah, when you said Boston, the first thing I think of is these little push-face dogs. Mm-hmm. They have all the normal anatomy of other dogs, except it's all crammed into that little head of theirs. And because I live with two English bulldogs that are just kind of a bigger version of what you're dealing with, I wake up and hear them snorting and so on and doing all kinds of, respiratory issues. And I get concerned with, does she have an elongated soft palate that is bothering her? These little, dogs with the crowded teeth will sometimes get chronic dental disease that can result in large lymph nodes like tonsillitis.
Okay.
So I don't know if part of her exam has been a sedated oral exam, but I'm glad that she, had a swallowing study done. I don't know if it was just giving her barium and taking an x-ray or whether they actually did fluoroscopy, which is a moving x-ray where you can actually see, are they swallowing normally? If they just did a static x-ray, that's going to show, yep, all the barium went down into the stomach, nothing's left. But what was the path when it went down there? Did she have trouble actually swallowing? And the only way you'd know that is to actually be watching her swallow under an x-ray. So it would mean a referral to a big referral center that has fluoroscopy capabilities. So I'd be more concerned about an anatomical issue than I would a behavioral thing. The fact that she's waking up in the middle of the night, she's not stressed. She's with the people that love her. So I'm like, that doesn't sound right. The reflux business, most dogs that have reflux at night will typically vomit. They get bilious vomiting syndrome where they get bile flushing up into their stomach. They wake up and usually their stomach's gurgling and they barf up a pile of yellow colored phlegm. And then if they eat something, they feel better and they go back to sleep. So we don't see a lot of GERD type symptoms like we do in humans, but it's always possible. And you've gone down that line. So I'd be looking more anatomically. What's going on with her that way?
All right.
Can I just have a quick follow-up? So in terms of cauterizing or whatever they do to that extra tissue, what are your thoughts on how effective that is?
Yeah, you'd probably want to deal with a good soft tissue surgeon, and they will go in and resect part of the esophagus, or not the esophagus, the soft palate, if it is elongated. And sometimes we'll find that these dogs will do reverse sneezing, kind of a snorting-y inhale. You can Google or go on YouTube and look up reverse sneezing, and you'll see that a lot of these dogs, and that may even be what your dog is doing. And it's not so much swallowing, but because their soft palate gets stuck up over their epiglottis, they sometimes have some trouble breathing and everything's acting funny. So Google or YouTube that and look at dogs that are reverse sneezing and just see if any of those match what your dog is doing. That's usually an indication that, they've got probably in the case of a Boston, an elongated soft palate.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Heidi, for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have Chantel emailed about our 2-year Karen Terrier. who keeps the farm free of rodents, how often should she worm her?
Oh, good question. You know, the when we've got dogs that are hunting and eating the rodents, that's when we get concerned. The rodents can carry a number of parasites that can affect dogs and people. Probably the big ones for dogs are going to be roundworms. And if you've got your dog on a monthly heartworm preventative, that should do the trick at getting roundworms under control. All of them have a roundworm capability of the medications that are given orally, and even some of the topical heartworm preventatives now. The other thing that we'll see is tapeworms. And there are two main tapeworms that we get concerned about, one called tinea, and those are ones you're going to be able to see in the fecal material or in the hair around the rectum. Why does this call always have to come right at lunchtime? But and so be on the lookout for those. The other tapeworm is called Echinococcus. That's the one that we get really concerned about as human beings because it can cause a condition called hydatid cyst disease if you do get exposed to the infective eggs that your dog could be shedding. Center for Disease Control recommends at least quarterly deworming. But an easier way to go about this, I mentioned heartworm preventative. There is a newer heartworm preventative called Iverheart Max that you can either get through your veterinarian or through an approved online pharmacy that has the roundworm, hookworm, and tapeworm medication included in there. And it's relatively inexpensive. It's really not much more than your standard monthly heartworm preventative, and it gives you that tapeworm control on a monthly basis. And I think that would probably be adequate to keep you healthy and your dog healthy.
All right, there we go. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's turn back to the telephones now as we talk with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk and to Mike in La Crosse. Mike, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I have a dog named Emma. She is a 12-year-old Scottish Terrier. Back in June, she was diagnosed with pancreatitis. She spent a few days in the veterinary clinic, and they treated her for that. She was given antibiotics and, I believe, prednisone at the time. And for about 3 weeks after that, she seemed to be okay. Her problem is right now, and this has been going on since the end of June, is that she has very soft stools. At times, it's actually pretty much just colored liquid.
Oh, my goodness.
And now she has had some other tests along the line. They did x-rays, an ultrasound, and basically they told us at the time that it looked like she had very, well, they called it angry-looking intestines.
Okay.
And since that, you know, they recommended one other possible thing to do was to actually have little snippet biopsies done,
mm-hmm.
which we haven't done up to this point. And some, we've also been other vets, and they are basically treating it like maybe she's got a food intolerance or a food allergy.
Oh, see, you're finding that this is a really good example of a dog having a symptom, diarrhea, and the myriad of things that can cause it.
Yeah.
And when you said that your dog had pancreatitis, that's inflammation of the pancreas, and it can be severe enough that you can have enough pancreatic damage done. The pancreas produces, kind of has two roles. One is to produce insulin and controls blood sugar. The other is to produce digestive enzymes. And sometimes we'll see those digestive enzymes levels drop below what the dog needs to be able to handle their food. And so it just goes in one end and out the other, and they get kind of greasy, foul-smelling diarrhea.
Right.
And there are some tests that you can do to look at levels, and there's some blood tests that you can do. It's a relatively easy thing to treat with using a pancreatic enzyme supplement. We already had somebody on the phone that mentioned that they have their dog on it already earlier in the show. So, you know, I don't know if that's been looked into, but that would be something that I would definitely do.
Well, I can say that she has had numerous blood tests.
Okay.
I know one of the things they said is that she was showing low protein levels.
Okay.
Below what the, you know, low count should be.
Yeah, and so when we start seeing protein levels drop, then we start worrying about things, what's called protein-losing enteropathy, where she's losing protein through her gut. And there are, again, a number of diseases that they that can have that happen, and often they are a biopsy diagnosis. Right. There's a condition called lymphangiectasia, where the lymph tissue in the gut becomes very swollen, and they develop chronic diarrhea, weight loss. And it can be managed dietarily, but it's, you know, it's a tough one to be able to get under control. So I think it sounds like, you know, you're the vets that you've been working with are right on the ball and doing everything kind of in a stepwise fashion, and now getting down to that last thing, getting biopsies. Mm-hmm. But I think you may be at that point if, you know, they've ruled out all the other conditions. And you know, it's not something you want to put your dog through, but if it means, you know, the difference between being able to be healthy or not healthy, as long as she's a good anesthetic candidate, I'd say go for it.
Yep.
Yeah. See, we have changed her diet numerous times, you know, trying to find something that's going to work.
Yeah.
Right now she's basically, because they're saying that maybe it's a food allergy thing, well, we basically been giving her cooked chicken breast.
Yeah, and that's not balanced, and she can't stay on that forever. And many dogs have poultry allergies. If you really want to rule out a food allergy, you need to feed probably a hydrolyzed protein diet, something that you would get from your veterinarian as a therapeutic diet. There's several on the market. There's one called HA that Nestle Purina makes. There's one called ZD that Hill's makes, where it's hydrolyzed protein and a single source, carbohydrate source, and that's all they get. You don't even give them the chewable heartworm pills. You have to switch to something else that doesn't have beef flavoring in it. Most dogs that have dietary allergies are also going to have some skin involvement, and I like to refer to food allergies as the ears and rears. They have diarrhea as well as they're itchy, but not always. So if your dog doesn't have those symptoms, again, I'd put food allergies kind of a little bit lower on the list, but it can take a good 6 to 8 weeks for symptoms to disappear when you're feeding them one of these specialized diets. But be really careful with long-term use of just a single protein item. That's not good for your dog in the long run.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Mike. Mary asks if there are good ideas for drying fruits and veggies for treats for dogs. Do they need seasoning or anything?
No, they don't. But you have to be careful about what fruits you're using. You know, definitely no grapes or raisins, which I guess are dried grapes. Okay. So for dogs can be very toxic. So keep those away. And, you know, other than that, I think, you know, they are a source of calories too. So if your dog has a weight issue, you're going to have to figure out, you know, okay, how many calories are in an apple? And when I slice it up, how many slices are there and incorporate that into your dog's daily caloric needs. But yeah, shouldn't be a problem at all. Avoid onions, no garlic, and definitely no grapes or raisins.
So here's a question relating to garlic. Sue wonders, how about garlic tabs to repel ticks instead of using Frontline? Are there side effects of too much garlic in dogs?
Oh, yeah. Big problem with dogs. Their dogs are not humans. And what we can run into troubles with is it can actually affect the red blood cells. And we can run into troubles with the hemoglobin or the oxygen carrying capacity in the red blood cells being affected. So do not give your dog garlic. Plus, it doesn't work. So I think you'd be much safer using a product like Frontline than you would be with giving your dog garlic.
Ron in Bloomington, Indiana, who's also listening online. Hi, Ron.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I have a male dog. He's kind of an Italian shepherd. His name is Vincenzo. And he has, he's been spraining his left front leg and where the joint is a little bit swollen. And the last time he did it, we took him to the vet, and they basically just said it'd have to heal on its own. And I'm wondering, well, there's two things, really, but I'm wondering if, like, ice packs or anything like that would help him out. And also, he has increasing, like, separation anxiety as he's gotten older.
Okay.
And a big fear of, like, loud noises and any kind of banging to where he'll start, like, shivering.
Well, two very diverse problems here. anytime you have orthopedic issues, if they can't find something that's surgically repaired, if it's soft tissue injuries around a joint, best thing you can do is rest your dog, okay? Just, you know, out to go to the bathroom, inside, resting. No, you know, limited use of the leg. Often we need to also give them a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory to take down the inflammation and discomfort and make them feel more comfortable. But just because they feel good doesn't mean they go out and exercise. Hot cold packs, possibly it may help take down some of the inflammation if the dog will tolerate it. But I'd be looking at more rest and anti-inflammatories as a way of dealing with that. The issue regarding your dog's phobias, this is something that, you know, many owners will kind of just like blow it off. You know, my dog's a little afraid of noises. They may, you know, jump when there's a little thunder or lightning, or they're, you know, pant a little bit when you're getting ready to go and they think, eh, you know, it's not bad. And then as the dog gets older, they start seeing these problems get worse and worse and worse. And so it's important for other people listening to deal with these anxiety-based issues when they're minor, before they become severe. Because once they become severe, now you're looking at, you know, a lot more difficult time getting them under control. There are many dogs that need to be on chronic anti-anxiety medications. There's whole programs we can go through with working on teaching your dog how to relax when you're getting ready to leave and then actually going out the door. One of the things I would recommend is there's a drug on the market for dogs that's fluoxetine. It's basically Prozac for dogs, and it's made by the Lilly Company, and it's called Reconcile. And they have a very good program outlined on their website with how to deal with separation anxiety. And I'd be, you know, be careful, you know, read through that and just see if it gives you any pointers. But big things, no punishment when you come home and you find that the dog's been destructive, because that's just going to add to the anxiety. Don't coddle the dog during a storm, because that's going to make the dog realize that this is the appropriate way to behave if I get coddled by my owner when I'm nervous. And talk to your veterinarian about medical management to give your dog a little bit of relief.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Let's turn to Joanne in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. This might be repetitive. I didn't quite hear the whole issue of rodent eating. We have an indoor cat who has turned into a wonderful mouser, but she does eat them.
Yeah, yeah.
Crunch. And we've had animals over the years, and I've seen worm evidence in different animals, and I've never seen anything, and she's fat.
Mm-hmm. Well, what should she do?
Yeah, well, you know, when cats are using a litter box, you may not see the tapeworm segments, or if you've got a cat that's a really good groomer, she may be grooming the segments off of her rear end before you get a chance to see them. So what the nice product for cats is there's a spot-on product that's made by the Bayer Company, and it's called Profender. And you would have to get it from your veterinarian. It is a prescription product, but you don't have to pill the cat. It's just spotted on over their shoulder blades. And again, just like we talked about before, quarterly deworming, or at a time if you're seeing anything going on within the fecal material that's abnormal. But that would be something to make it, you know, easy for you. No pills. If you are really good at giving pills, the drug that I would recommend orally is called Drontal, and it's a combination of two drugs that will get tapeworms, rounds, and hookworms as well. But my favorite is Profender. I have a cat that's an avid mouser, and boy, if I had to give him a pill, I'd be mincemeat. So it's so much easier to just put this on his back.
All right. There you go. Thanks, Joanne. And let's see, we've got Pat asking if canned pumpkin is useful for upset stomach in dogs. And what about cooked winter squash?
Well, pumpkin is a great source of fiber. And so if your dog has an upset stomach, meaning when I hear that, I think, you know, the dog has vomited or, you know, something like that's going on. First thing you want to do is withhold food. Giving more food, especially fibrous type food like pumpkin, is just going to irritate the stomach even more. So off food until the dog's tummy settled down, and then onto a bland diet, which temporarily could be something like boiled hamburger, boiled chicken, and rice. Again, about three parts of, you know, white rice to one part of the protein source. and, you know, then segue back into their normal diet. Again, talk to your veterinarian. There may be other symptoms that are going to be, you know, needing to be addressed as well. There are some commercially available bland diets as well that pretty well do the same thing. They're low in fat, low in fiber, so it gives the whole GI tract, stomach through intestinal tract, a nice rest for a few days. So where I use canned pumpkin is in dogs that have problems with, you know, maybe passing stool. They need it for remaining, you know, a little looser so they're not as constipated. That sometimes helps because it adds more moisture and a little bit of plant-based fiber. So okay. I wouldn't be using it for an upset tummy.
Let's turn to Mary Beth, who's in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, listening online. Hi, Mary Beth.
Hi, Larry and Dr. Sawchuk. What a privilege. I learned so much this morning.
Thank you.
A 10-month-old wire-haired pointing Griffon. He is sitting here right next to me right now looking at me with the saddest look on his eyes because he knows what I want to talk about. His vets are very young, and they have been insisting since he was 16 weeks old that he needs to be neutered now.
Mm-hmm.
One even went so far as to schedule his neutering before I even agreed to it. Now, his breeder and his trainer both insist that to avoid joint and bone problems, we should hold off until he's a year and a half or 2 years old. Yeah. What are your thoughts?
Well, I tell you what, I think what we'll do is if we could bring this topic back up,
yeah.
We have to break for news, and I will be glad to address this. So if you want to just
stay listening.
Stay listening. We'll bring this up in a few minutes.
All right. Thanks, Mary Beth. Keep listening, and you keep listening, too, as we visit with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. We'll be back right after a quick look at the news. Stay with us. Great to have you along here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Mary Beth in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, phoned us about when to neuter a puppy.
Yeah, she has a 10-month-old wire-haired pointer that sounds like it's, you know, it's she's dealing with the breeder and the veterinarian and so on. And with male dogs, it's not something that's cast in stone as to when it has to happen. And, you know, I've brought this up before, but if you wait until he sexually matures, until he's like a year and a half to 2 years of age, they tend to develop more of the secondary male characteristics, the wider chest, the muscling, and so on. And so you may have an appearance change from neutering them pre-puberty. They tend to have a little bit softer appearance. And so some people like that look. Now, the downside of waiting until he has reached puberty and is now a fully developed male is that you run increased chances of behavioral issues. Fighting with other boy dogs, wandering, lifting their leg, masturbating, chasing after girls, and so on. And so you do have those behavior issues, and some of those will not go away after castrating. So there's very little health issues that make a difference between neutering at 6 months and neutering at 2 years of age. So again, I'm kind of sitting on the fence here because if he's a field dog or they're potentially wanting to breed him or show him, they need to keep him intact long enough to see how he develops and how he works in the field before they make that decision to take him out of the gene pool. So as long as she's a responsible owner and not letting him meet up with girls willy-nilly, then I think waiting is not a huge problem.
All right. There you go, Mary Beth.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Ann in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Ann.
Hello. My cats, I have two cats, they're both overweight, 14 and 16 pounds, and it doesn't matter what food I feed them, so I've been contemplating making my own food to feed them. What do I need to do to make sure they get all the nutrients and...
Oh, you know, a homemade diet for cats is a tough one because they, being strict carnivores, they have very specific amino acid needs. And they still need to have some carbohydrates and so on in their food as well. But they should be getting, you know, at least a third of their diet is made up of protein. If you're going to be doing a home-cooked diet, I would strongly recommend that you work with a company that is, there's a couple of online companies. One of them is called Balance It. www.bordnutrition.com. It's run by board-certified veterinary nutritionists, and they can help you with formulating a diet and giving you the correct supplements that you can add to your diet. But it's with overweight cats, it's not so much what you feed, but the a number of things, the caloric intake. And so just switching from one brand to another, again, even though it says for less active cats or obesity management, you still have to feed the correct caloric needs for your cat. The other thing that we like to see is that the majority of the calories come from a protein source. So we want a high protein, low fat, relatively low carbohydrate diet. That seems to help maintain their metabolism a little bit better, support lean body tissue, which is going to burn calories faster. So just taking a regular standard cat diet and just cutting the volume that you're feeding to meet their caloric needs, they may actually not lose weight very well. So again, working with your veterinarian, one of my favorite diets, and I don't mention like exact brands very often, but is the obesity management, the OM diet that Nestle Purina makes. It meets the needs of the cat. It's calorie restricted, high in protein, low in fat, and moderately carbohydrate restricted. And so it gives you the Katkins diet, which is a little bit better for cats. And remember, exercise, exercise, exercise. Putting the food up on windowsills, on top of the cat tree, on top of shelves, make these cats exercise. You don't have to just feed them in a bowl, but actually make them exercise. And the fact that you have two means feeding them separately so that they both get what they need and they're not stealing food from each other. It's a tough thing to come up with a well-balanced homemade diet. I'd work with your veterinarian with a therapeutic diet and then institute some of these other lifestyle changes, and hopefully we'll get the pounds off your cat.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ann. Heather in Brookston, Minnesota. Hello.
Good morning. I have three standard poodles, and they're all hippies. They've never had fancy poodle haircuts. I have two brothers that are four. They started out black. One of them is now what they call blue. He's actually gray. His name's Inspector Clouseau, and his brother's name is Monet, and he's still jet black. But I have a problem. Well, what happened was I also have a third, and she is a six-year-old, and her name is Soufflé. Soufie's wonderful. She's a wonderful, well-mannered poodle. The boys, on the other hand, Clouseau growls viciously at Monet all the time. This is after 4 years. If Monet gets too close, he just growls like mad. I mean, he scares me even to this day every time he does it.
Oh, my goodness.
And Monet is, I used to think he was deaf, and I realized he's slow. Mm-hmm. I can't teach him to sit, to walk on a leash without choking all the time or anything. But he's the most happy-go-lucky dog, and he's snuggly and fun and everything. He's like a 14-month-old black lab. So what happened was I got a DAP collar for Soufflé because she's afraid of lightning or thunder. And then I thought, I need it more, maybe try it out with the other two. So, well, it worked okay, but the pills work better for Soufi.
Thunder. So she's on anti-anxiety meds. Okay.
Yeah, but I tried it on Clouseau. He was not as awful with his brother, but I'm starting to think, now that's a lot of extra. Well, I'm on a very limited income now, and I wasn't when I first had these got these dogs. And then I tried it on the collar on Monet, and I got to the point where every other day I was switching the collar back and forth. Because Monet also has separation anxiety, so when I leave them at home, he's just a wreck. He has shredded any kind of blinds that I have on the windows corner of the house when I drive down the driveway.
So what can I help you with?
Okay, here's the question. I really need to get a new home. I want to say wonderful things about the collars, but the thing is, I really want to find a new home, probably for Monet, because this harassment from his brother really isn't good for him. I think he could have a wonderful home. He just needs to have somebody at home.
Right.
How detailed do I need to be? I tend to go overboard, and I don't want to scare somebody away because he's a wonderful dog, and I think somebody would spend the time training with him probably get him to do things.
Yeah, and I think that any time, you've got a purebred dog, I would work with Poodle Rescue. Reputable rescue groups are going to take a very thorough behavioral history. And people will, you know, you have to be able to be upfront with them because you don't want to hide things and have it be a surprise for them. But it sounds like that's probably a good idea. Whenever we have age-matched, sex-matched dogs, whether it be male or female, it's usually worse with two girls living in the same house, we can get some sibling rivalry. And it can escalate to become quite severe with dogs injuring each other. And so, you know, you can work with them behaviorally and try to get under control. But in many cases, the nicest thing to do is say, let's rehome one of them. And that way, you know, they don't have the grief of having to, you know, always be on edge because the other dog is going to attack them for coming up too close to them, approaching you, going through the door the first time, walking down the hallway too fast, whatever it may be. Work with a good rescue group. You can go online, talk to your local Humane Society. A rescue group is going to then be making sure that the family that they go to will be their forever home. Many rescue groups will work with foster families, and they'll be able to see what he's like, either in a home with other dogs or by himself. And they can get sometimes a better feel for how he's going to be in a new home as well. So I'm proud of you for recognizing that, you know, this may be better for him. And you're going about it the right way with, you know, being upfront with everybody regarding their problems. And good luck. And I hope that everything works out well for him.
Thank you very much for calling. And good luck, Heather. Appreciate it. Denise in Toma, we are going to turn to you next. Hi, Denise.
Well, hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. I was wondering, Dr. Sachuk, if you had an opinion about traveling by air with pets. I have a pug, and I need to be in a location that's going to be quite a bit warmer, flying into the very tip of Texas, most southern tip.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have an opinion about...
Yeah. The big issue with even just on the news recently was there were some bulldogs that died because they went in the belly of the plane.
Oh boy.
So flying on board is probably, you know, your best bet. I don't know if your dog is small enough to be able to fit underneath the seat, but any of these push face dogs that are going to be stressed, maybe get overheated, and so on, are really at high risk of running into troubles. And what we find, too, is that medicating the dog prior to travel when they're going in the belly of the plane actually increases the risk of having complications.
Oh boy.
So, you know, the brachycephalic push-face dog, I avoid having them go in the belly of the plane. There is, and I don't know the name of it, an airline that is dedicated just to pets. And they don't have seats for passengers. It is just for pets. And so they have the staff on board. And so they all fly in the belly of the plane. It's quite reasonable. I'm not sure if they fly in and out of, you know, any of the major cities around here, but that might be something to look into. And I know that if you just Google air transport for pets, that's one of the first websites that comes up, is this unique airline just for pets. So check that out and see. Be on the lookout for the travel embargo times. Airlines where it's going to be above, like, I think it's like above 80 or something, they don't let pets travel in the belly of the plane when it's going to be above 80 on either end of the trip. And they have the same thing in the winter. You have to show that your dog is cold adapted if it's going to be less than 40, because they don't want them to turn into a little popsicle when they're out on the runway. So, if you're forced to do this with the pet, be a weather watcher. Make sure that you're traveling early in the morning, late at night when the temperatures are a little bit cooler. Get your dog adapted to the crate well before you do that. So they need to be able to go in there and be relaxed. Travel with the pet. Take the pet into Home Depot or something so they get used to being wheeled around in noisy environments in a crate.
She loves wheels.
Okay.
She's got her own stroller.
Okay. Well, good. If you can, on board. If not, you know.
Oh, I would love to take her on board. She can flatten herself out pretty good, but let's put it this way, dainty, she ain't.
Okay. All right. And they have to be comfortable, and they have to be able to fit in a, you know, something that would fit underneath the seat. So, you know, don't stress her by cramming her in something and she's too, you know, way too big for it.
Sounds like a better drive.
Okay. Good luck.
Thanks, Denise, for calling. Appreciate it. And we'll turn to Matt next, who has a question. Matt, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me on. I got a 8-month-old American Pit Bull Terrier. He dislocated his hip when he was about 4 months old playing around with my buddy's dog. And I like to go running 2 miles every day. And I like to take him with me, but I can't tell if he's having any pain or anything there. So I'm just wondering, you know, have I waited long enough? Can he go running with me every day? Or
I assume that your veterinarian has probably re-x-rayed the hip and shown that there's no arthritic change, that it's a nice tight fit, that everything's corrected. I really worry about that just simple play dislocated the dog's hip. That's like really a severe injury to happen just in play. If you had said he'd been hit by a car or he had a major fall or something like that happened, then I could understand. But I start worrying, does he have any underlying hip abnormality like hip dysplasia that allows that hip to be more lax to allow it to come out more easily? So go back to your veterinarian, have them palpate the hips, perhaps take another hip x-ray, make sure everything's healthy and normal there. I like to wait before we start doing any major road work with dogs until they're fully developed, a year or so of age. So playing at a dog park, you know, out in the backyard, chasing a ball, doing that kind of thing, but actually hitting the pavement where they're hitting a hard surface, they're running, you want to wait till their joints are fully developed. And he's still developing right now. So give him a little bit of time before you do that. But especially with his history of having this hip, I'd be even more careful with, you know, getting him checked out before you hit the pavement.
All right.
So you said at a year?
At about a year, yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. We have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. We have an email here from Andy and Kathy. We have a male husky lab neutered, about 7 years old. Lately, we've noticed that his stool has a flat-like appearance to it. My concern is that there might be some type of tumor or obstruction in his colon. Otherwise, stools seem normal frequency, no diarrhea. How is this diagnosed when he's taken to the vet? What else might be going on?
Well, when I hear ribbon-like stool, the first thing that comes to mind is prostatic disease, a prostate problem. Intact males, we have to deal with both prostate cancer and then also this condition called benign prostatic hyperplasia, which is where the prostate just gets big and can act like a big ball valve back there in the colon because it's kind of stool has to pass over it. And if only a little, you know, it's flattening the stool out, you're going to see like ribbon-like feces coming out. Neutered male dogs, you basically take the benign prostate problem off the table, but you still have the issue with prostatic cancer. So first thing I would do is go in, describe this to your veterinarian. They would probably put a glove on and do the finger test. But depending on the size of the dog, you may or may not be able to get all the way in there where you need to. And so then you're looking at taking an x-ray to see if the prostate's big, or better yet, getting an abdominal ultrasound where you're looking at the caudal abdomen and can look at the bladder, the prostate, the sublumbar lymph nodes, the lymph nodes that sit back there as well, and see what is back there. But I would be betting on prostate disease.
Here's another. Megan in DeForest has an 8-year-old female lab husky mix and has had a series of seizures for the last 2 years, has them every 30 days, about the 18th of the month, and she's biting her tongue, swallowing the blood, and aspirating blood.
Oh, my goodness.
Hours after the episode, they have her on. Diagnosed as epileptic, placed on phenobarb and mirin, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Daily. Her pheno levels have been tested, still low. About 14. However, upping her dose of pheno causes her to drink a lot and urinate everywhere. When she has an episode, she's physically exhausted for a day, and we're concerned about the pain she may be in.
And
so forth. So it's so hard to to see her with these episodes. She's fine for a month again until the next episode.
Yeah. We
purchased a calming collar last night. Seems to have relaxed her after her episode Sunday. Anything else you could suggest that we should try? Our main concern, though, is our dog is in pain during and...
Yeah, I know. And these are, I mean, it's horrible to see your dog go through this. And if that's happening once a month and it's giving the dog a couple of days of being not themselves and bleeding and so on, boy, I mean, I'd be going back to square one and saying, what can we do for seizure control? Phenobarb isn't the only drug that we use for seizure control. There's other drugs that we can use. And sometimes we end up piggybacking another drug. Primarily what I would then go to as my next drug to add into the phenobarb would be potassium bromide. It's safe, it's inexpensive, and it's something that, you know, you use once a day. And so for many dogs that are intolerant of phenobarb at higher levels, you can maintain them at a lower level of phenobarb along with this drug. So that would be the first thing I would do, is go back to the veterinarian and say, let's try a little potassium bromide and see how our dog does. And again, you can get this. It's, you know, readily available through veterinary pharmacies now.
Brian in Green Bay, hello to you.
Good morning.
Morning. Hey, what's on your mind?
Well, I have a question. We've got two dogs and they both have the same habit. You put them out to the yard and all the little rabbit droppings.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And one of the smaller of the two dogs, also, if you leave her out there too long, she'll eat her own feces. But I don't is there health risk problems with that? We try to keep it cleaned up, but...
Well, yeah. For the rabbit droppings, actually, no. I mean, I think you've got the aesthetics problem. Your dogs are coming in and you know what they've been eating and they're mm-hmm. wanting to give you a kiss and cuddle up with you. And it's like, it's gross, but it's fairly normal dog behavior. It's just not something that we like to tolerate. The only thing that you may periodically run into troubles with is dogs that eat rabbit droppings will sometimes pass a rabbit yeast organism called Cinnaclomyces, and they sometimes pass a coccidia organism called Imeria. Neither of those cause health problems for dogs. It's just going in one end and out the other, and we happen to see it under the microscope. But I recently had a dog that a boarding kennel declined them from boarding because the stool sample came back positive for Imeria, and I was like, well, it's not a dog parasite. They've just been eating rabbit poop. But uneducated people can sometimes misinterpret a stool report, and that could be a problem. Eating their own droppings, again, dental issues. You're packing this bacteria onto their teeth, and just the gross out factors. So best things you can do, number one, two, and three, pick it up, pick it up, pick it up. Putting them out in the backyard is not the thing. You need to be out there with them. Instead of eating rabbit poop, let's chase a ball. Instead of eating your own poop, I'm going to pick it up and throw a frisbee. So it does take an owner interacting with the dog so that there's less ammo there for them to eat. There are things that you can mix in with the food that make the stool taste bad. They rarely work if it's a longstanding problem, but you can talk to your vet about adding one of those in as well.
Okay, Brian, thank you for calling. Lori in Middleton, you have a quick question.
Hi. I have two cats, and one of the older cat, we live in Michigan, and we have just recently returned, and when we were there, he was diagnosed with acute hemolytic anemia.
Ooh.
Which I understand is more prevalent in dogs. Doesn't happen too much in cats. And they're tying it back to his the first set of immunizations that he had, which mm-hmm. were the leukemia one, the cat leukemia one, and the whole set, the rabies and everything. So they think he had a reaction to that, okay. And that's what set it off. He was on steroids for a while. We about lost him. He almost mm-hmm. had to have a blood uh-huh. transfusion, the whole thing. But he came out of it, and he was on steroids for a while. And then I read about the fact of keeping him on steroids for a long time, but they told me it was going to be a life thing. Well, I worked him off of them. He's been fine for like 2 years now.
Good, good.
Well, my concern is whenever, and we're going to have to change vets, obviously, from moving back, is every time they want to immunize him.
Don't. No. Okay, get titers done. It's a simple blood test. This would not be a cat I would ever vaccinate again. And so just, it's a matter of drawing a blood sample. So getting titers, that's what you need to ask. Is your veterinarian, is this new vet that you're going to be working with willing to work with you with this? And they should be. And it's a simple procedure. We do it all the time at the veterinary school. But avoid vaccines in the future, because that probably was one of the triggering factors for autoimmune hemolytic anemia.
There you go. And with that, we have to conclude. Sandy, thank you so much. You're back on November 16th.
I am. Yep.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. She'll be back on November 16th. And thank you all very much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.